Hello and welcome to Gender Troubles. I'm Emma Austin.
I'm Eva Espenshade.
And we majored in gender studies.
So you don't have to.
We are on Twitter at GenderTroubles1, and we're on Instagram at gender.troubles.pod, and we have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/gender_troubles.
And Gender Troubles is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Harbinger brings you progressive podcasts from all across Canada, and you can find them at harbingermedianetwork.com.
Woo! What are we going to talk about today?
Today, we're going to talk about the male gaze. Yes. I wanted to do something a little lighter. And I'm realizing also that, like, talking about film, but, like, you're on a podcast can, like, be a little tricky, maybe. It's like that thing, like, what is it, like, writing about music is like dancing about architecture or whatever the saying is.
Yeah, it's really hard to describe things visually on a podcast, and I feel like whenever I look at our stats and like when people drop off listening, it's always when I'm trying to like describe a graph or something.
They're I'm like fair,
you know, no one wants to hear that though. It's like
so... and then on the x-axis.
So we'll see how this goes. Cool. But yeah, so the male gaze, I feel like, is like a really common concept nowadays. And it's also a concept that can like really easily stretch from like, say, radical feminist spaces to like pop feminist ones. I feel like a sassy, like alternative best friend character in some like Netflix teen drama would like totally have the male gaze like as a term in her like little spunky feminist lexicon, along with like smash the patriarchy or whatever.
Yeah. She'd have a button.
Exactly. But when you like dig into the origins of the term and like the history of it, you can kind of really see how what we talk about when we talk about the male gaze has really shifted and expanded in some ways, I think, to make it more accessible. And also it's kind of losing kind of its origins and the point it's trying to make. So the male gaze is really credit to this woman, Laura Mulvey. She wrote a piece in Screen in 1975 called Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema. And this is kind of the touchstone for all discussions about the male gaze. She's a British feminist film theorist who uses psychoanalysis to kind of conceptualize the relationships between the spectator and the screen and the subject. And Laura Mulvey herself is also a filmmaker. She like co-wrote and co-directed like half a dozen avant-garde films in the 70s and 80s with her husband at the time, the artist Peter Wallin. And many of her films are rooted both kind of in feminism and psychoanalytical theory. So here's a like the opening paragraph from Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema. Quote, "The essay takes as a starting point the way film reflects, reveals, and even plays on the straight, socially established interpretations of sexual difference, which control images, erotic ways of looking, and spectacle. It is helpful to understand what the cinema has been, how its magic has worked in the past, while attempting as a theory and a practice which will change the cinema of the past. Psychoanalytic theory is thus appropriated here as a political weapon, demonstrating the way the unconscious of the patriarchal society has structured film form." So, a little wordy, but you kind of can get what she's trying to say.
Yeah, definitely.
And many of the examples she uses in her essay are looking at like older Hollywood films like Hitchcock and movies starring like classic starlets like Lauren Bacall and Marlene Dietrich. And according to Mulvey, kind of the center of her argument is two things are happening when you go to the cinema and watch a movie. Because keep in mind, this is 1975, so it's not like you're, you know, watching something on your phone. So first, there's kind of a voyeuristic element, where you're kind of like a peeping Tom in this dark theater. And the second is a narcissistic element, where you're identifying with a protagonist, or like what is being portrayed on screen. And she talks a lot about scopophilia, which is not necessarily spelled the way you think it's going to be, given the pronunciation. And basically it means like the pleasure of looking. Here's a definition of it from the Sage Reference Encyclopedia. Sigmund Freud first introduced the concept in 1905 in his three essays on the theories of sexuality. Scopophilia refers to the pleasure of looking as well as the pleasure of being looked at. It therefore has both voyeuristic and exhibitionist as well as narcissistic overtones. Laura Mulvey points out that, like, while you're watching a film at the cinema, like, the audience takes on the role of the gazer, like the peeping Tom does kind of in the outside world. And all these kind of elements contribute to this. So the darkness of the theater and the audience each being, like, individually isolated in their own seats can really lend to this voyeuristic fantasy. And though, even though, like, the actors are, like, consenting to have themselves be looked at in a way that's different than if you were just, like, creepily looking at someone in the real world, they also, like, move across the screen and they're kind of ambivalent to the audience and the audience's actions. Mm-hmm. Typically, the protagonist is male, especially in, like, old Hollywood movies, or mm-hmm. if the protagonist is kind of female, or there's one of the main characters who's female, she's used on, like, two levels. One, she says, as an erotic object for the characters within the screen story, like a love story, like a love interest or a femme fatale, and as an erotic object for the spectator within the auditorium.
Right.
And so, like, to Laura Mulvey's credit, like, what she's trying to accomplish in this piece is, like, very specific. She's, like, saying, I am using Freudian and Lacanian psychoanalytic theory to demonstrate how narrative cinema shapes and perpetuates masculine heteronormative dynamics of power and privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And now when we talk about the male gaze, it's, like, much more broadly, meaning, like, men objectifying women plus, like, camera or right. painting.
Mm-hmm.
And... like, I think the male gaze, like, can be a really useful framework for critiquing art that kind of extends beyond, like, this is what Freud would have to say about Rear Window. And you don't need to be well-versed in critical theory in order to, like, have some standing in the feminist film debate. And, like, honestly, you don't need to read critical theory at all if you don't want to. but, like, the way we've discussed before in the podcast, like, as different feminist frameworks and terms get disseminated into wider popular culture, the origins of the concepts and kind of their intended impact can get kind of lost. Mm-hmm. And the male gaze is a really good example of that.
Yeah, I feel like the way I've most often used this phrase or, like, heard it used just in, like, day-to-day life is actually, like, now just, like, talking to other women and being, like, talking about, like, the actions that we perform as part mm-hmm. of, like, the male gaze, like, without thinking about it.
Totally.
So, like, kind of feeling, like, this constant need to, like, perform a certain type of, like, sexuality or, like, just, like, way of being in the body because you're sort of on display in this way.
That is, you didn't know that. That's a great segue to my next,
nice.
My next point. Oh, yeah. So like I said, like, Laura Mulvey is kind of really credited for, like, the male gaze theory, but the person who kind of, like, first introduced the concept is a man named John Berger, who's, like, a British art critic and kind of, like, general artsy Renaissance man. And he produced a series of half-hour-long films for BBC Two called Ways of Seeing in 1972. And I'm sending you episode 2.
Men dream of women. Women dream of themselves being dreamt of. Men look at women. Women watch themselves being looked at.
And after the show aired, John Berger also published a companion book, which is also called Ways of Seeing, where he can kind of expand upon his thoughts and expand upon the script. So here's a quote from the book that's also kind of an expansion on the opening bit you just heard, where he goes, mm-hmm. One might simplify this by saying men act and women appear. Men look at women. Women watch themselves being looked at. This determines not only most relations between men and women, but also the relation of women to themselves. The surveyor of woman is herself is male. The surveyed female.
Wait, I'm sorry.
Oh my god, that's so cute.
My cat's interrupting.
Go.
Oh. Every time he comes in the cat door, he has to announce his presence.
Like, I have arrived.
I'm here.
Oh. Okay.
I'm sorry, no, you were saying.
That's so cute. No, we'll start from the beginning. So basically, he's saying, men act and women appear. Men look at women, women watch themselves being looked at. This determines not only most relations between men and women, but also the relation of women to themselves. The surveyor of woman in herself is male, the surveyed female. Thus, she turns herself into an object, and most particularly an object of vision, a sight. So yeah, a lot what you were saying around typically how we talk about the male gaze as being kind of self-reflexive, like how I myself am performing in some ways to a male spectator, even if there's no male spectator to be performed to. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like this conceptualization of women like knowingly presenting themselves to appease kind of patriarchal expectations of is nothing new. Like Simone de Beauvoir writes about this, and so does Betty Friedan, and like many of the popular second wave feminists. John Berger sets up like the whole second episode of Ways of Seeing around like what's perhaps like the most obvious example of the male gaze in art, which is the female nude painting.
Right.
So I have another clip for you.
A woman in the culture of privileged Europeans is first and foremost a sight to be looked at. What kind of sight is revealed in the average European oil painting? There were portraits of women as there were portraits of men. But in one category of painting, women were the principal, ever-recurring subject. That category was the nude. In the nudes of European painting, we can discover some of the criteria and conventions by which women were judged. We can see how women were seen.
I love this footage. It's so good.
I know. It's definitely, it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
The aesthetics are on point. Again, this is the problem with having a podcast about visual media.
We'll put the links in the chat.
We'll put the links. Yes, well, the links will be put in the show notes so you can watch this beauty. Yeah, so like he's talking about the female nude, which is just kind of ever present in like Western classical art. And in the book companion, he kind of expands upon this idea of nudity versus nakedness, which I think is a really great example of kind of a way to identify like the male gaze in action. I was wondering if you maybe wanted to read these two pieces.
For sure.
You could do your best British man voice if you want, or not.
Yes. To be naked is to be... No, I won't do it. Okay, first quote is, "To be naked is to be oneself. To be nude is to be seen naked by others and yet not recognized for oneself. A naked body has to be seen as an object in order to become nude. The sight of it as an object stimulates the use of it as an object. Nakedness reveals itself. Nudity is placed on display." In the average European oil painting of the nude, the principal protagonist is never painted. He is the spectator in front of the picture, and he is presumed to be a man. Everything is addressed to him. Everything must appear to be the result of his being there. It is for him that the figures have assumed their nudity, but he, by definition, is a stranger with his clothes still on.
Yeah, so another way you could say that is just by looking at the... very famous 1989 poster that the like feminist art performance art people, the Gorilla Girls, did, which just says, mm-hmm. "Do women have to be naked to get into the Metropolitan Museum? Less than 5% of artists in the modern art section are women, but 85% of the nudes are female."
Yeah. I took like a whole class on this, like the modern art era. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it was a point in time when like women of like a certain status weren't really allowed to like go out into certain areas that were like considered like culturally interesting, you know, and they always had to be like accompanied by a man. And so it was like always men that were like, you know, going into like, I don't know, like the underground theaters and the bars and the taverns and the like the brothels and stuff and like painting. And then women artists were like, you know, painting like the domestic space and the home and like, or doing like handicrafts and stuff like that. And like the hierarchy of like what has gone down in the canon as like good art is like always like the nude women, but not like the table with like a bowl of fruit or something, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And like nakedness versus nudity, I think is like, I said, yeah, like it can be a way to kind of examine a painting, but also, you know, a film and like the whole thing of like gratuitous nudity, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'll be like, why is this person naked right now? Like they shouldn't be. But I also like how it's not implying that like any figure who isn't wearing clothes is kind of being objectified specifically, or that was the intention. Like that's the difference between like the naked person and the nude. And so like the nude is very much ties into the male gaze, ties into this idea of like being on display. Mm-hmm. And another thing that John Berger looks at in his Ways of Seeing series is the parallels between like classical art and modern day advertising. And like sometimes like an ad will like literally like mimic the composition of a classic painting, or they'll like utilize similar techniques to like elicit a particular experience for the viewer. And there are like so many advertising campaigns like since the beginning of ads that like present women as literal objects or to like kind of serve as the focus of the ad with like the actual product being secondary. And like this is, mm-hmm. you know, like this is feminism 101. Once you notice it, you can identify it. It is everywhere. So Laura Mulvey and John Berger's work are like really foundational to feminist film criticism and media criticism. And there's also like many critiques to be had with both of their theories. And at least to me, like the most apparent one is like the male gaze theory is like really hegemonic and really heteronormative. Like, what about queer people? What about mm-hmm. the queer gaze? Like, what about bodies that are not socially considered desirable? Like, how does the male gaze theory fit into when we talk about, you know, disability or, mm-hmm. you know, race or nationality, all of these other aspects of kind of identity and how that can fit into this, again, initially very specific framework for looking at old films.
Yeah, I feel like this, like, I think it is, it's a interesting framework to like think about, for instance, like the pressure of passing and like, mm-hmm. like trans identity and like sort of being on display if you're not passing as a specific gender and like fitting into the binary. Yeah.
A really good academic essay I found that kind of really breaks down some of like the large critiques within queer theory of the male gaze is a piece by Carolyn Evans and Lorraine Gammon called The Gaze Revisited or Reviewing Queer Viewing. And you know, I love a title that either has a pun and or wordplay. So they, you know, see the male gaze theory as being like pretty inadequate for contemporary criticism because its scope like is super regimented and narrow. And they talk about like why they wanted to write this essay, and they say, quote, both in and out of college, the phrase the objectifying male gaze has become a cliche used to identify the way men look at women, almost as a metaphor for patriarchal relations. Within such cliches, there's no space to conceptualize queer relations of looking or to explain changes in some context where women's experiences is not completely defined by patriarchal discourse. Nor is there any space to talk about the implications of a fashion system which encourages women to take pleasure from images of other women, or an advertising mm-hmm. system which uses eroticized images of men to sell product to both sexes.
Right.
So yeah, they're really drawing attention to how queerness kind of throws a wrench into the whole male gaze theory. And they emphasize like context as well as text when analyzing a film or really any piece of media. So, like, in other words, it's not just, like, what images are being produced on screen, but, like, who is producing them and who is the intended audience for. And they also know, like, media can be produced with multiple audiences in mind. Like, you know, you can have a a sexy male actor who is being advertised and shot in a way that's meant to, you know, make heterosexual women want to, you know, find him sexy, and gay men to want to find him sexy.
Right. Or straight men to want to be him.
Exactly, exactly. And another really obvious issue with kind of the original male gaze theory is race. Mm-hmm. There's a piece I really love from Janelle Hobson called Viewing in the Dark: Towards a Black Feminist Approach to Film. And she examines like Black women's representation in film, and she really interesting moves beyond like the visual gaze and says we should be incorporating sound as well into our analysis. So like she notes that Black female characters in mainstream cinema like usually fall into two categories, like the kind of sympathetic, asexual, nurturing mammy figure, or the like hyper-sexualized, unable to control her emotions kind of Jezebel figure. Or they're just completely absent from the film altogether. Mm-hmm. But Janelle Hobson also discusses that, like, while narrowly and barely present on screen, the Black female voice is often much more present, and it's used as a literal and figurative sounding board for the white protagonist's character development. So the most obvious example in this is having a very important moment for a character, the white main character, and you have a song playing over it that's sung by a Black woman, or can be about specifically the experiences of Black women. Another way she describes Black women's voices in film is kind of serving as a Greek chorus, and you can think of like the muses in Disney's Hercules, like a literal Greek chorus.
Well, this is just all over popular music for the last like literally since forever.
Completely. So here's a really great example she gives from her piece, where she talks about Schindler's List, which I have never seen and have no intention of seeing it. But she says, another illustration of the disembodied Black female voice, though quite brief, comes in the pivotal scene in Steven Spielberg's 1993 Schindler's List. The turning point for Oscar Schindler, who makes the life-changing decision to use his money to save as many Jews as possible from the death camps in World War II, is dramatized in a scene of contemplation. After lovemaking, we are led to assume, as his blonde white female partner lies asleep in bed, partially nude and serving as a sex object for the camera, Schindler gazes out the window while listening to the diegetic sounds on the radio of Billie Holiday's sad, meditative God Bless the Child. Holiday's voice in the scene serves two purposes: to sexualize the white woman in Schindler's bed with sultry vocals, and to raise the conscience of Schindler himself as Holiday sings a song of salvation and self-reliance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it also makes me think of like abject bodies, mm-hmm. like bodies that exist outside like the sort of like general beauty conventions or popular beauty conventions, and like fat women in films are often like desexualized and like made into such like grotesque caricatures that they're not even real characters anymore, you know, like so it's interesting to think about, yeah, like who's being gazed upon and why.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so kind of with these critiques of the male gaze, you end up too with like a host of other like proposed alternative gazes. So you have the female gaze and the queer gaze and the teenage gaze and the et cetera, you know what I mean? and I'm honestly not sure how like useful or revolutionary these, you know, alternative gazes are when it comes to creating a more equitable, like representative and non-exploitative film industry. A lot of the time, like the female gaze is attributed to films where the director is a woman, which like makes sense. Right. But also where like the aesthetics are more muted and moody or girly. So like Sofia Coppola is a great example. Like in her early work, like The Virgin Suicides, it's like really steeped in soft pastels and dreamy music and like stylized interior spaces. And she also loves casting skinny blonde ladies for all of her roles. Yes. So again, like, who is being represented in alternative gazes? Mm-hmm. I also find, like, more, I don't know how else to say it, but, like, sensual sex scenes or, like, less explicit sex scenes are used as an example of a film's female gaze. But that can, like, really run the risk of implying that, like, women's sexual desires, like, can't be explicit or kinky or objectifying.
Yeah. We're just, like, sweet and we want sensual.
Exactly.
Just deep connection all the time.
Yes. And implying that, you know, women cannot objectify other women or objectify men, or, again, not really taking into consideration, you know, the dynamics within race and class that can lead to objectification. And also, like, you can have soft visuals and a female protagonist and still have, like, say, a weird 5-minute montage of, like, a hot lady in a bikini dancing around with some balloons in a slow motion. And what I'm talking about there is Euphoria. Great example. If you've seen it, you know what I mean. Was that scene necessary? No, it was not. And I think kind of a more constructive path forward, as opposed to kind of alternative gazes, is really digging more into, like, just not just the visual representation, but, like, the content and character development in a film. So, like, a great example here is, like, the Bechdel test, which, if you don't know, is put forth by cartoonist Alison Bechdel, who lives in Vermont. Love to see it. And she says, like, for a movie to pass the Bechdel test, it has to have two women in it who are both named and are talking about something with each other besides a man. And that's become, again, like, a really, in some ways, a little bit of a shorthand, the way the male gaze is, to categorize films into, you know, like, there's websites, like, you know, does this film pass the Bechdel test or whatever? And it'll be like, Lord of the Rings, no, or like, Citizen Kane, no, or whatever. But I think it's a good example of how our expectations as, like, kind of feminist consumers have moved beyond just, like, who is present on the screen, but, like, what are they doing? And I also think, like, this links back to what Janelle Hobson's talking about with the need to consider audio as well in kind of film criticism. And so,
like, yeah, what people are actually saying to each other versus just who's saying it.
Yes, that's very nicely. And, like, the last thing I kind of want to touch on here is, like, something that is not really discussed when we discuss the male gaze, which is capitalism. So
what's that?
Going back to Laura Mulvey and psychoanalysis, like, understandably, like, a lot of Marxists have, like, a real critique of using psychoanalysis, because it privileges, like, you know, one kind of separation of people by gender over kind of everything else. So Jane Gaines, in a piece she wrote called Women and Representation, Can We Enjoy Alternative Pleasure?, says, quote, for Marxists, the use of psychoanalysis is especially problematic, both because it privileges an autonomous realm and because it poses a subject that is undifferentiated by either social class or history.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Mulvey's theory is built upon Freudian analysis, and you kind of need to accept Freud's theories without question to make all the different parts of visual pleasure and narrative cinema work.
Yeah, accepting any Freud theory is hard for me. just gonna go ahead and say it.
Exactly. And a lot of the initial responses to visual pleasure and narrative cinema from feminists who were kind of proposing moving beyond this male gaze theory were saying that, you know, it can be really inaccessible for people. And, like, what is the point? What are you trying to make by, like, proposing this theory? Like, what do we gain from identifying the male gaze? How do we move beyond that? And if part of identifying the male gaze is predicated under, you know, on understanding what Freud has to say in his, like, three essays on sexuality, like, who is that really serving? And how is that going to change, you know, how the way films are made? And also, like, Laura Mulvey, her films, her avant-garde films, were criticized for being kind of inaccessible or, like, staying in the realm of, you know, kind of artsy academia in a way that, if this was going to be a form of, like, praxis for her, was maybe not coming across fully.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm super biased here, but as someone that works in, like for, like, community media and, like, making, like, media making accessible, like, yeah, you're always going to be kind of, I mean, I feel like so much of filmmaking is just reproducing class, because there's such a steep curve into just getting into it, or like you have to, like, the gear that you have to have, the training you have to have, even if it's like unofficial training. I'm not saying you have to go to film school for 4 years to make a movie, but like, you have to have a lot of technical knowledge and have a lot of time with very, very expensive equipment in order to know what you're doing, and in order to get the grants to do it or get the funding. And usually the funding comes from your rich relatives, because a lot of filmmakers are just born into privilege and then they recreate it, you know? Yeah. So it's like, you're not having a lot of like, there aren't a ton of like, you know, blue collar working class filmmakers out there, like, telling their own stories.
And that shapes, yeah, like the gaze, like the film industry is an industry, and like the writers and directors and like cinematographers, like, they lead a movie's vision. They can, you know, really obviously dictate stylistic and content choices, but they're not the only one shaping a film. And like, I think it's so important when we look at the way, you know, women are represented on film, or the way sex is represented in film, or the way bodies are naked or nude, is also being like, who is financing it and what is being pushed? Mm-hmm. Like, a film is not just a singular piece you can, I mean, I guess you could make it on your own, but you know what I mean? Like, especially like a highly produced, you know, film that anybody could go see. Like, there's a huge machine behind it that is also dictating, you know, how people are being portrayed. And I think sometimes too, when we talk about, you know, the female gaze, if you have a female director, that doesn't necessarily mean that your film is going to have like better representations of women.
Or like ethical representation. Like, I can think of a few examples of TV shows or movies created by women that like really like objectify and very unethically objectify like Black men's bodies, for example, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not okay.
No. And
just because like a lady did it doesn't, you know, it always goes back to the whole like, just because a lady's doing it doesn't mean that it's feminist.
Doesn't mean that it's feminist. And like, and also though, like, you know, one of my best friends and roommates was in film production at Concordia. And so I watched many a student film, which have very little funding. And even a lot of those had the male gaze. Like, I'm not trying to, you know, kind of downplay how, you know, the theory of the male gaze can really be a good jumping off point for media criticism. And I know personally for me, like, as a baby feminist, like, being able to be like, oh, this is, I am being sold something, you know, in magazines and in TV, and I can identify it. And that's like really important, because, you know, that it's kind of the first, can be the first stage of, you know, creating a more liberatory world.
My new identity category is baby feminist, by the way. I like that a lot. I am but a small baby feminist.
I'm just a baby.
Please don't come after me.
And I kind of wanted to circle back, kind of shifting gears a little bit, but to John Berger's talking about advertising and, you know, the male gaze and advertising in classical films and, or in classical art. And a shift that I've been seeing recently that I feel like you can probably relate to is like how not only are we as like female consumers being sold, you know, a specific type of femininity through film and whatnot, but also the way we're being sold is changing. So like, ads used to be like, buy this so you can like please your man or your boss or your family, and now it's like, buy this so you can like please yourself. And it's like a great example of like the cultural shift away from the male gaze towards something that's supposedly more liberating, but at the end of the day, like, it's still a marketing campaign. So like, even if your ad is no longer referencing like the birth of Venus and instead like Judith chopping off the head of that guy in the Bible, like, if it's still selling you something, like, I don't know how much more feminist it can be. So that's my little talk about the male gaze. And
love it.
Yeah, I think there's there's a lot that has been said about the male gaze and the female gaze and the queer gaze and, like, all of that. And I'll include a lot of links in the show notes. Yeah, I hadn't really revisited kind of the origins of the term. And so that was hopefully enlightening for some people.
Yeah, it was super enlightening for me. I had no idea that that was, like, based in Freudian and Lacanian thought.
Yeah, so that's things are surprisingly you can, like, trace it surprisingly back to Freud a lot more than I would personally want, but
yeah, that's unfortunate. But
do you know what we're talking about next week?
Yes, next week / maybe in 2 weeks, because
next time, let's do this. You know what we're gonna talk about next time?
Yes, next time we are going to talk about postmodern feminism. So I've already started researching it. It's going to take me a while. There's a lot to unpack there, but
I can't wait. We'll see you then. Thanks so much.
See you then. Thank you.